watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. I'm your host, Lynn Gary. What happened during Hurricane Katrina demonstrated starkly that the fate of poor people is of little concern to the people who run things in America. Flood victims were left to starve, then shot at when they tried to get food, then given a one-way ticket to anywhere, while developers moved in to grab their land for future vacation condos. This should be a cautionary tale as to what to expect in the event of an economic meltdown that suddenly brings millions of people into the ranks of the poor who never expected to be in that position and who, without a paycheck, have no means to fend for themselves in a society where money must be paid to somebody for even the most basic needs, water, food, shelter. Blaming poverty on personal failures has been all the rage in America since the 1980s, and the myth of self-reliance persists in a society where it has been impossible in fact for more than a century. I mean, it's not like you can find a piece of vacant land, build a log cabin, plant some corn, hunt some wild game, and draw water from the creek. For most people, the only food they've ever seen comes from a grocery store or a restaurant. The captains of industry drove people off the land and into the cities, then into the suburbs. Underwriting this whole process was cheap fossil fuel, now much less cheap, and destined to become more expensive. The widening ripples of the rising price of petroleum, the basis of almost everything in this society, means more downsizing, more mergers, fewer jobs, more people with no money to spend who still must live. Based on the events of Katrina, help won't be coming from Washington. They are building detention centers and passing laws to enable people to be rounded up and put in them without any trial. It's time to think about making other arrangements to ensure our survival and well-being. The topic addressed by our speaker this week, James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency. His talk will take about 90 minutes, then we'll conclude with our next installment of John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The sound quality on Kunstler's talk is not the greatest, but it is intelligible and the content is worth every minute. It was recorded last May at a bookstore in Eugene, Oregon. Thanks to Krishna Singh Khalsa for making this available. Here's James Howard Kunstler.
As I go around the country to colleges, I notice that the people in the audience aren't hearing what I'm saying. And, you know, we do the comments and questions afterwards, and they say, "But you didn't give us any solutions." This is the cry I hear constantly. So I want to say this just right out front at the beginning now, and I may repeat myself several times. But there is no rescue remedy for the set of problems that we face. You know, there's no silver bullet. But there is definitely a comprehensive set of intelligent responses that we can bring to this set of problems and challenges. And what they mainly all revolve around is making other arrangements. Making other arrangements. And Unfortunately, what you're hearing at every level of the public discussion all over the country is only one theme, which is let's keep the cars running at all costs by any means necessary. That's the only thing that we're interested in this culture. At every compass point and dimension of the discussion. But the real key to how we're going to succeed, for those of us who will succeed in this time of turbulence and difficulty, is that we're going to comprehensively make other arrangements. Okay? So, I'm going to assume that a lot of you actually understand some of the fundamental theories behind the global oil predicament. I actually don't like the term peak oil because it has cultish overtones. And I'm not really hustling the occult here. I really like to think that I live in a reality-based frame of reference. And so I like to call it, you know, the permanent global oil crisis that we're moving into. So you understand that? Raise your hand if you know a bit about that. Pretty much most of the people in the room. Okay. And, you know, I don't think that I need to reiterate the whole model for you, but just to give you the sort of schematic idea of really what it's all about. You know, Mr. Hubbard, the geologist, described the model for the depletion of oil fields in the middle of the 20th century. He was a guy who, Mr. Hubbard, the geologist, worked for the Shell Oil Company's chief geologist and later was a professor at the Colorado School of Mines in Columbia University. And he created a mathematical model to describe the depletion of oil fields. And it became obvious to him along the way that same model could be applied to the aggregate of the oil fields in a given place, like the United States. You know, if you could model how one of them depleted, you could pretty much, you know, model the way the whole national oil industry would rise, peak, and fall. And so on to the global model. And so Mr. Hubbard predicted that United States production would peak in 1970, and all of his colleagues laughed at him in the 1950s and 60s, and lo and behold, 1970, it turned out, it was the highest year of production for conventional crude oil ever in America at about 10 million barrels a day, and now we're getting to 5 and heading declining further from there. And when we peaked and it became obvious to everybody in the world, because the American oil industry was transparent, you could get the numbers pretty freely, you could see through the industry. When the other players in the global oil markets discovered that, they seized the pricing power in the oil markets. And that brought on the crisis of 1973, the OPEC embargo, and then a second one when the Shah of Iran was toppled in 1979. That was more of a price-jacking kind of affair. But the real bottom line of the oil crises of the 70s was ultimately, we were able to compensate for the loss of our own production by going to other countries and getting oil from them. And that's what we did, pretty much, and that's where we are today. Now, the trouble is now that the whole world is at or near the global all-time production peak, we can't go to another planet to import more oil. And that's the nature of the core of the problem. And we have many reasons to believe that we are, in fact, at the peak. There are a lot of other things going on in the background of that major part of the story that are also interesting that the public is generally not clued into. One of them that I think is important is that increasingly what you see in the oil markets is that the light and sweet crude oils that have been really the basis of our cheap, easy-to-refine oils, which yield the most gasoline, they are actually depleting first. And we're now compensating by adding in more heavy and sour crude oils, which are harder to refine. In some cases, cannot be refined in the refineries that we have, and yield quite a bit less gasoline. And so what you're getting is, out of the total of oil that we import, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of about 15 million, it's more like 13 million barrels a day, we're getting a lot more heavy and sour crudes than we used to. So that's another thing that's responsible for sort of destabilizing the price situation. I find, though, that I am more interested in some of the psychological aspects of this lately. The Long Emergency book, of course, is concerned mostly with the implications of the global oil predicament. And it's not just laying out the oil story itself. And because of the supernatural cluelessness of the American public in the last couple of years, I've become much more interested in the psychodynamics behind what we're seeing, behind the behavior that we're seeing in the public and among the leaders of the public in politics and business and science and technology, and among the media, the mainstream media especially. And it's all very interesting. So that's sort of what I want to talk to you about tonight. And first, I want to sort of lay the groundwork for one element of this, which is the whole suburban question, which it has to do with, you know, the living arrangement that Americans consider normal, and it is at the bottom of a lot of our particular problems with the challenges that we face. I wrote three books about suburbs and cities, and I've spent quite a bit of time reflecting on these questions. And in fact, when I first wrote The Geography of Nowhere, which was my first book on the suburbs, eventually it was impossible to not, you couldn't fail to notice how the oil equation entered the picture ultimately and would determine whether we'd be able to carry this project of suburban living on in the future. And I came to the conclusion even then, you know, in 1989 when I started writing the book, that the likelihood was that we wouldn't. It wasn't until the middle 90s, actually, that some of the great oil geologists of the late 20th century started retiring out of the system. And as they did, and as they established their pensions and their income streams for their senior years and felt safe, they began to publish their actual thoughts about where the industry was headed. And that's where you get the guys like Colin J. Campbell, who wrote really the first monograph about peak oil in 1995 or 6, and started to alert the public that there was indeed a problem, and to do it in a coherent and non-hysterical way, and in a way that was comprehensively backed up by empirical data. Anyway, writing about suburbia and its problems, you know, you couldn't fail to notice that its chief characteristic was that it had no future. You know, it was a living arrangement based on having endless supplies of abundant, cheap petroleum and natural gas. And as soon as you realized, you know, that wasn't going to be happening, then you couldn't fail to come to the conclusion that it was a living arrangement with no future. And so you could then describe it succinctly as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. Because the United States, the richest culture, civilization, society that ever existed, at least at a certain time, the late 20th century, we poured all of our national wealth into this infrastructure for daily living, which had no future. Very foolish project, unfortunately. But, you know, life is tragic. Life is tragic. That's one of the things we've left behind, by the way. And it's an important thing, which is a recognition that life is tragic. It's something that I think all great cultures manage to integrate into their collective imagination. And we have basically drop-kicked it out of ours as being inconvenient, and it doesn't comply with the philosophy of Walt Disney and Steven Spielberg. So it's no longer in our collective imagination. But the problem with suburbia is compounded by the psychology of previous investment, which is entailed by these circumstances. And by psychology of previous investment, I mean that you put so much of your collective resources into a way of life that you can't imagine letting go of it or changing it or putting it aside. And that's really the basis of the predicament that we're in. We put so much of our national wealth into building, you know, basically stuff like Eugene, Oregon, with the highway strips and, you know, all of their furnishings of suburban living, that the only thing that we can imagine now is just desperately trying to find some way to run all those cars up the commercial strips. So, big problem. And one of the conclusions that I've come to is that no combination of alternative fuels or systems for running them is going to permit us to run what we're running, or even a substantial fraction of it. We are not going to run the interstate highway system, Walt Disney World, and Walmart on tar sands, oil shale, solar, biodiesel, wind, uranium, algae that produces hydrocarbons, or any combination of those things. And a great deal of the trouble arises out of the wishful thinking that attends that desire to somehow get a rescue remedy for the interstate highway system in Walt Disney World and Walmart. So I also want to be very, very clear about this. We're going to use everything we possibly can. I'm not saying we're not going to use these things. We're going to use biodiesel and oil shale and tar sands and blah, blah, all that. We're going to use everything we possibly can. It's not going to compensate for the losses that we're going to incur. And we're getting a tremendous amount of disinformation and misinformation from the major media. I tend not to consider it, you know, a conspiracy, because I'm allergic to conspiracy theories. I don't know, it's just something about me. I hear them and then my mind just tunes out. I don't think it's a conspiracy, but it is a remarkable thing that they're doing such a poor job. And you know, you saw it coming in particular this winter from 60 Minutes and CBS News. They ran one segment on 60 Minutes in the winter that said the tar sands contained the equivalent, in the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, contained the equivalent of 2 trillion barrels of oil. It's just bald-faced untruth. Just stark, not true at all. The actual figure for the tar sands is probably in the neighborhood of 50 to 70 billion barrels of recoverable hydrocarbon liquids once you cook them and process them at great expense and also at great environmental cost, environmental damage. And you know, there's a big difference between 2 trillion and 70 billion. We use 7 billion barrels of oil a year in the U.S. And in the U.S., not including Canada. Canada uses several million more. And so even if you just run the numbers on that for the tar sands, it doesn't, you know, we're not going to get that forever. A few weeks later, 60 Minutes put on another segment with Governor Brian Schweitzer of Montana saying liquefying coal into liquid fuels for running cars and trucks mainly would be the rescue remedy that they were looking for. That's not true either. That's not going to happen. Actually, the coal that is there, there is less coal there than most Americans believe, and it is of poorer quality. And the processing of it is hugely expensive, both in just sheer energy investments and also in the environmental damage that's created from doing that. It's not going to happen. Then CNN came out a few weeks later saying that ethanol made from sugarcane and, by extension, from corn and from cellulose would save the interstate highway system. So I don't want to beat this to death, but the public is consistently getting the message that don't worry, there are all these rescue remedies out there, and they're all real good, and they're all going to, we don't have to change the way we're living. So the message is don't think about making other arrangements because it's not necessary. And that's a very dangerous message. So we will try to use everything possible, but we're not going to use them in the way that most people think. for example, I don't believe we're going to see very many wind farms built of the, you know, the turbines the size of Godzilla deployed in, you know, masses of them, 400 units on a gigantic scale. Because another key to the problems that we face, the circumstances that we face, is that it's going to require us to downscale everything. And scale is really going to be the most important issue. And anything that is designed to operate at the gigantic scale probably isn't going to work. Whether it's a giant government like the U.S. government, or a giant corporation, or a giant university, or a giant healthcare system. You know, all the gigantic things, the gigantic centralized secondary school systems, all these gigantic systems are probably going to get into trouble. And the same thing applies to energy. So I think that what we will see is people using these things on the very, very, very local basis, and probably the household basis for some of them. And that is going to engender a whole other range of strange and interesting problems, mainly having to do with the jealousy and resentment and grievance of the people who don't have it. And whether or not you're even going to be able to keep the stuff, you know, screwed under your roof. It's kind of funny, but it's ultimately going to be a serious issue. Because another one of the key elements of what we face is that our future is liable to be disorderly. One of the things that many commentators consistently get wrong, in my opinion, is that they assume that there's going to be an orderly transition between where we're at now and where we're going. And I encourage everybody to check their assumptions about everything at the door. And that's one of the main things that you have to check at the door, your assumption that this is going to be an orderly process in an orderly society, because I think it probably won't be. Well, Vice President Dick Cheney said that the American way of life is non-negotiable. And yeah, we laugh because we realize that statement does not comport with reality. You know, and we understand why he said that, too, I think. You know, you had this country that was attacked in a very strange way, knocking down office buildings with airplanes, and, you know, the public was shocked and frightened, and they needed to have their spirits bolstered, so the vice president gets up and makes this statement of bravado. Our way of life is non-negotiable. The trouble is that that really did represent the point of view of most of the American public, who actually believe that they're entitled to this way of life no matter what. And that's a problem, because if you don't want to negotiate the things that life sends at you, the circumstances that life sends at you, you automatically get a new negotiating partner. They assign you a new partner. You call reality. And it negotiates for you. And it will direct your behavior. It will compel you to do things differently, whether you like it or not. By the way, this idea that the American way of life is non-negotiable is related to another idea, which comes from a lot of places right now in our society. It also interests me a lot. It's the idea that the American way of life, namely suburbia, is okay because people like it. And that's obvious, you know, it's a transparently fatuous bit of reasoning. But it's exactly the position of David Brooks at the New York Times, and Peter Huber at Forbes magazine, and Joel Kotkin and Bob Brugman of the University of Illinois. It doesn't matter whether we like it or not. A related point that these guys sometimes, or argument that these guys sometimes make, is that the American way of life, the suburban, easy motoring, driving utopia, is cool because we choose it. And that's sort of a way of stating the, restating that we like it with some, you know, democratic political overtones to it. But the deal is, it's coming off the menu. You know, you're not going to be able to order it up anymore, whether you like it or choose or want to choose it or not. So those arguments are fatuous. Now, that those arguments, you know, the American way of life is cool because people like it and because they choose it and because it's non-negotiable, they're related to yet another more basic idea, which is believed in by most of the public, which is that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. And, you know, it's laughable because I think we recognize that this is an idea that is mainly subscribed to by children under the age of 7. And it's a sweet idea. There's no question it's a sweet idea. It's a sweet sentiment. It's the kind of thing that, adults take a lot of pleasure in telling their children. It helps with that transition from, you know, the more undeveloped realms of childhood into the growing world of reason that children enter between the age of 6 and 8. And so you tell them when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. You know, it helps them get through that, make that transition with a little less friction. But the problem is that adults cannot continue to believe that themselves. You know, you really, in fact, you can state categorically that that the ability to make a distinction between wishing and doing is one of the basic things that characterizes adult development in the human species. And so when you've got a big problem now in American culture where you've got a whole group of adults, a whole cohort, maybe even two or three generations of adults, you know, me, the Generation Xers, and whatever parents of my parents' generation are still left, you know, that all now believe that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. It obviously comes from being bombarded with Steven Spielberg movies in Hollywood and Walt Disney and incessant commercials on radio and television for your whole life. You know, you're bombarded by this. And so we develop this mentality, but it's a very, very dangerous idea. Now, it is combined with an even more dangerous idea that has come along in maybe the last 3 or 4 decades, I think. It's a little bit newer. And it's based on America's greatest new religion. Most people think America's greatest new religion is evangelical, Pentecostal, born-again Christianity, but it isn't. America's greatest new religion is the worship of unearned riches. And it's symbolized by Las Vegas. And the worship of unearned riches is in turn based on the idea that it's possible to get something for nothing, which is another thing that fully developed adult human beings would be better off not believing. But we believe it. And our whole culture is now attuned to that idea that it's possible to get something for nothing. And by the way, that's why Las Vegas is okay with virtually every group in America, including the Pentecostal Christians. They don't object to it at all. You see Jerry Falwell jumping up and down saying, well, Las Vegas is bad, legalized gambling is bad. I happen to think it's very bad, and you know, not even on just, you know, not religious grounds at all. But I think that it is extremely corrosive, because believing that it's possible to get something for nothing, among other things, defeats all of your earnest efforts to really contend with reality in any real, concrete way. So, a big problem. Now, one of the primary delusions that are spawned by these kinds of thoughts that are accepted as normal in American society is the belief that technology and energy are the same thing, or that they're interchangeable, or that you can substitute one for another. You know, if you run out of one, you just plug in the other one and you're okay. And I saw a really fascinating example of this last June. I was invited to give a talk at Google headquarters in Silicon Valley. And I went to the auditorium, you know, I went, actually, first, you know, they took me down to the building, And my first impression was very illuminating. The building, which is a suburban office park building in Silicon Valley, was tricked out like a kindergarten. And they had the foosball games and the non-hockey games and the computer consoles and the pinball, and they had the Lucite snack stations with filled with little boxes of gummy bears and yogurt-covered pretzels and malted milk balls. Because if you work at Google, you can never be more than 11 steps away from a sugary treat, or your brain will stop working. And so, I'm checking this out and thinking, this is really kind of interesting, sort of like kindergarten here, And then the Google executives and engineers came into the auditorium. And these are people at the absolute top of high-tech corporate enterprise in America. And they're all dressed like skateboard rats. They're millionaires, too, because they got in on the ground floor with Google, and they've got all these stock options, and, they're high-tech, genius, high-tech corporate millionaires. They're wearing the sideways hat, and the sneakers with no laces, and their ass cracks are all showing. And I'm thinking, I had no idea that the highest level of American corporate high-tech enterprise was so infantile. But it's infantile. And then, so I gave my blab. Now I'm doing a blab talking about them. When I did my blab for them, I wasn't talking about them. I was talking about all these issues. And, I was actually, at that point, still trying to lay out a case for oil and alternative fuel and blah, blah, blah. So when it was all over, we had questions and comments, or no questions, just one comment expressed 14 times from 14 different skateboard rats. And the comment was, like, dude, we've got technology. Case closed. Don't worry. Now, the subtext was, you're an asshole. We've got technology. Clearly, they didn't understand that technology and energy were different things, and you couldn't plug in one for the other. And this is the highest level of high-tech thinking in corporate America. Really amazing. the airplane that I flew here today on, a Boeing 737 or whatever it was, those things are either going to run on liquid hydrocarbon fuels or they're not going to run. You're not going to fill them up with technology. And we're not going to change out the entire aviation fleet of the U.S. either. We're not going to just take all the 737s and 747s and 57s and park them in Arizona and get airplanes that work on solar. It isn't going to happen. We're not going to have an aviation industry if they don't run on hydrocarbon fuels. And so, to hear the people at Google say, dude, we've got technology, that's a very troubling thing. And I can see where it came from. Because, they've spent the last 10 years moving pixels around the screen with a mouse and making millions of dollars doing it. And so what you're seeing is tremendous grandiosity of thinking. We're omniscient and omnipotent because we can move pixels around the screen. We can make anything happen. So the kind of twisted ideas that are coming out of our culture right now are just unbelievable. When you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. Just wish for a rescue remedy, and it will be delivered by them. It's possible to get something for nothing. Energy is the same as technology. Incredible ideas. But we're not going to, we're going to be disappointed with that. So what can we do? Well, we can make other arrangements. We can make other arrangements. But even at the highest levels of the environmental movement, we're not even thinking about that. You've got the Rocky Mountain Institute devoting its institutional muscle and money and effort to this quixotic program of developing a hypercar. This is what they've been doing for 12 years. Amory Lovins at the Rocky Mountain Institute trying to develop a hypercar. And the main consequence of that is nothing more than promoting the idea that we can continue to be a car-dependent society. Is that smart for environmental people and institutions? It's incredibly dumb. And yet, that's the quality of the leadership that we're getting. You know, the quality of the leadership we're getting in politics is also kind of deplorable, but, you know, and you can see where that's coming from, too. One of the other insidious things about the suburban sprawl situation is that it is not only our living arrangement, it has also become our economy. You know, that's what the housing bubble is, the replacement for the manufacturing economy, which we have, you know, steadily gotten rid of. And if you subtract all of those activities from the housing bubble, the development of the residential subdivisions on this massive scale, and all of the accessories and furnishings that go with them, the strips and the strip malls and the big boxes and the fried food establishments and the mortgage mills and the secondary and tertiary activities that spin off of that, you know, the bundling of debt, which is to say loans made to people who had never qualified for one and or demonstrated any ability to pay money back at supernaturally ridiculous terms of, you know, no interest only, adjustable rate mortgages. And then you take all those mortgages and you rebundle them into securitized debt, and then you start circulating them around the financial markets and the derivative markets until they've flown so far into the realm of abstraction that they just sort of disappear with a little ping. And if you take all that stuff associated with the housing bubble economy and subtract it from the rest of the economy, all that's left is fried chicken and open heart surgery.
And war.
Thank you. And war too. And so that is a serious impediment to a political leader being able to get up in front of a group of any Americans and actually state the truth, which is, look it, you can't continue to have an economy based on little more than building one suburban box after another in multiples of thousands in places that people aren't going to be able to get to and from in 5 or 10 years, and to build boxes that people aren't going to be able to heat in the wintertime. And, you know, that's why, you know, you're not hearing that from the Democrats as well as from the Republicans. And, you know, I'm a registered Democrat. I don't make any bones about that. I'm not a neocon. Some people seem to think I am. But we have to make other arrangements. We have to make other arrangements. The Rocky Mountain Institute has to make other arrangements in doing other things. If they had put one-tenth of the muscle and effort into the project of walkable communities or public transit that they put into the hypercar, we would have benefited a lot more as a society, but they didn't do that. We're going to have to restore public transit in America. This is one project that is terribly important. We have to restore the passenger railroad system in America. We have a railroad system that the Bolivians would be ashamed of. We have to do better. For one thing, we're probably not going to have an aviation industry the way we have in the shape and form that we have it now, if we have it at all. And we're going to have to be able to get to places in America in other ways. We're going to have to rebuild the railroad system, and it's the infrastructure for it is sitting out there rusting in the rain. We know how to put it together. We know how to make it run. It doesn't require any reinvention or any heroic new technology. And the fact that we're not even talking about it at any point in the political spectrum shows how unserious we are as a people, what a nation of clowns we've become at every level and in every department and field, the media, politics, education, technology. We don't want to think about this. It's terribly important. No other project would have a greater immediate impact on our oil use than fixing the railroad system in America. And it's important for one other reason. Very, very important. We need a project that we can do, that we can accomplish, that would actually bolster our confidence and enable us to feel capable of facing all the other tasks that we have to face in this comprehensive response to the lung emergency. Because we're going to have to put a lot of effort into doing a lot of things differently and changing a lot of systems for how we do things. And this would be a very good start because we already know how to do it and most of the equipment is still out there. So it's terribly important that even at the individual level of everybody sitting in this room, that you know whatever effort you're putting into other political things, maybe transfer a little bit of it, enough to write a letter to your senator, your congressman, your mayor, your governor, saying we have to get the railroad system running in America and we have to take this seriously. So that's a sort of a pet peeve for me. When, you know, there's this whole other comprehensive set of projects that we face. And in keeping with what I started saying at the very beginning of this talk, I'm gonna enumerate these things and give you a rough idea, I think, of what the agenda is. We're gonna have to comprehensively change the way we produce food in this country, the way we do farming, agriculture, the way we feed ourselves, and the way we move the food around the country. We're gonna have to do it a lot more locally. The places that can't do it are gonna be in trouble. Some of them are places that probably never should have developed the populations that they have now. Places like Phoenix and Las Vegas are going to be relatively unsuccessful because of this and other reasons, but largely because of this. And what? We are going to have to get away from industrial agriculture where you pour the oil and gas byproducts on the soil and the cheese doodles come out of the ground and the little Pepsi-Cola fountains spurt out of the ground. You know, we're going to have to probably use more human labor, probably far fewer petroleum inputs. And this is one of the arguments that I have, by the way, with the alternative fuel freaks. And I met a whole group of them at Middlebury College last spring. And they were very disappointed in what I had to say because, you know, they were young and they were, to some extent, extremely idealistic and perhaps even a little naive, but, you know, they were very enthusiastic about biodiesel being the rescue remedy for this problem. And, you know, when I spoke to them afterwards, I asked them, I said, you know, has it occurred to you that when we stop pouring natural gas-based fertilizers and oil-based pesticides, et cetera, on the soil, our crop yields are going to go way down. And we're going to have to devote more of our crop lands to growing food for human beings, not growing fuel for Toyotas and Fords. You know, and their response was not unlike the Google people. It was like, oh, dude. You know, it was like the palm to the head moment. They never thought about that. You know, we talked about something else. Has it ever occurred to them that we might have to use more working animals in the farm landscape in the decades ahead, you know? And I don't know what percentage it is. I don't know whether it's 3% more, or 23% more, or 13% more, or 50% more. I really don't know. But it's going to be something. It's going to be something. And all those animals are going to have to, we're going to have to grow feeds for them, and we're going to have to devote crop lands to growing feeds for the animals, to some extent. You know, has that occurred to them? No, it hadn't occurred to them. So they were making, you know, they had to check their assumptions at the door. And they were assuming that everything was going to be just like it is now. We would just sort of switch the allocation. You know, instead of growing a million acres of sugar pops here, we'd grow 500,000 acres of sugar pops and 500,000 acres of fuel for the Toyotas. And that's a simplistic level that we're thinking about. But we're going to have to change agriculture comprehensively. And the process is, again, liable to be very disorderly. Not an orderly transition from what we're doing now to what's going to happen in the future. For one thing, you know, there's going to be a whole new class of people in this country, a whole new class of economic losers, a big class of economic losers, the formerly middle class. There's going to be a lot of them, and they're going to be bewildered and full of grievances and resentment and anger at the loss of their entitlements to the non-negotiable way of life, because they believe that, you know, that that way of life is non-negotiable. How did they lose it? How did they lose their entitlements to that 4,000 square foot mick house? How did they lose their entitlement to that pension that they were promised? Or that job that they were supposed to have? Or the incomes? Or the medical care? Or whatever else it is. You know, the whole bundle of things. And they're going to be very, very ticked off. And many of them may have to end up working in agriculture. And if that happens, you know, there's going to be a very large aggrieved class of people who are working in ways that are going to make them very angry. So all bets are off about what the social relations are going to be in the future among the different classes of people in this country. And by the way, I'm the farthest thing from a Marxist that there is. But we have to anticipate that, or that's got to be part of our thinking. Ask ourselves, what are the social relations going to be? How are we going to reallocate land? Who's going to do the reallocation? What kind of position are the people who own good land going to find themselves in? It's very troubling. Well, that's one area that we're going to have to change. And we're going to have to do it whether we like it or not. It's not going to be, you know, the David Brooks idea that, you know, we don't like it, so we don't have to do it. Well, we're also going to have to reorganize and downscale and change comprehensively the way we do business and commerce in this country. Because the big box, national chain retail, gigantic scale organization of huge chains of manufacturing supply and retail distribution and the warehouse on wheels and all that stuff, is not going to work in this long emergency because the economic equation is not going to be the same. It's going to be vastly different. And especially where truck transport is concerned. So what we're probably going to have to do, again, whether we like it or not, is rebuild local networks of economic interdependency. In fact, these are the very networks that were systematically destroyed by the big box stores. And the big box stores did that with the full permission of the American public. The American public asked for it. Because they didn't understand the nature of bargain shopping. They didn't understand the nature of the bargain. And the bargain was, we'll let you save $7 in a hairdryer, and then we'll go destroy your community. And that's the bargain that Americans went for. Because you know what? Life is tragic. Life is tragic, and history doesn't care if we pound our civilization down a rat hole. And that's what we did with bargain shopping. And we're going to have to rebuild those networks. And when we do, we will have economic roles that are also accompanied by social roles. And we will have communities on a local basis, people living profoundly and intensely more locally, in which the people who run businesses locally will also have to take responsibility for the social roles in their communities and supporting their communities and supporting the institutions in their communities. And I think that will have many benefits for us. In fact, if you go around America today the way I do, and you know, I am all over the place, burning jet fuel. Sorry. But you know, just in the last 2 weeks, I was all over the Midwest, you know, seeing the little towns in the Midwest and the old industrial cities in the Midwest. In my part of the country, which is the Upper Hudson Valley and the Mohawk Valley, which is an old Rust Belt in upstate New York. You know, you go around to these towns and they look like former Soviet backwaters. They are so destroyed. You know, the destruction is so impressive. But we are going to have to get those things up and running or we're not going to have commerce and trade. Now, I hasten to add that the consumer, well, consumer shopping fiesta is going to fade into the backgrounds of our lives, you know, from here on. That very abnormal experience is not going to remain in the forefront of our lives anymore. It's going to fade into the background. We will have fewer things to buy, and there will be less hours devoted to recreational shopping. You know, maybe very few. But it doesn't mean that there isn't going to be business and trade. Of course, one of the big beefs that I have, and I think it's, you know, similar to the beefs that the so-called ecological economists have, is that we tend to, we've gotten in the habit over the last 100 years of referring to any economic activity as growth. And I think what we have to do really is change the term from growth to economic activity. Because if you understand it as economic activity, there are all kinds of ways you can have economic activity without having hypertrophy, and you know, essentially the growth model of a cancer cell. But you can still have economic activity, and we're going to have it, and people will trade. We're going to have to comprehensively change education. Like all the other things organized at the giant level, the universities probably aren't going to make it, but the public universities. University education itself will probably either become, once again, an elite activity, or it may just not exist anymore. The centralized secondary school systems all over America, where we have the yellow fleets of school buses that are going out every morning and collecting the children in a 70-mile radius area, they're not going to work very well in an energy-scarcer future that we're facing. And indeed, they're not working very well right now. My own personal opinion is that kids will be lucky if they get the equivalent of an eighth-grade education in the decades ahead. But of course, they're now coming out of graduate school without the equivalent of an eighth grade. We may just be spending fewer years pretending that it's education. And of course, we're going to have to inhabit the terrain of North America differently than we have been. And we're probably going to have to return to the traditional forms of human ecology known as the village, the town, the neighborhood, the city. The city, I think, is not going to be the city exactly that we're familiar with. It's not going to be the 20th century industrial colossus. I think that our cities are going to substantially contract, even while they densify at their centers and probably around their waterfronts, because water transport is going to become very important again. And so that's another one of the strange kind of ideas that we fell into over the last 50 years, especially the last 25 years, is thinking that waterfronts were only for condominium sites, picnicking, and bike trails. And we're going to rediscover the hard way that you actually have to run ships and boats and have facilities for them and wharves and warehouses and all the other infrastructure that we've spent the last 60 years getting rid of. We're going to have to get back again. You know, the entire island of Manhattan no longer has any working commercial wharf sign whatsoever. It's an extraordinary thing. But it's going to have to come back. At the same time, you know, I also offer this idea to you that I think is probably true. I think that the cities that are overburdened with skyscrapers and megastructures are going to have an additional layer of trouble. It's going to be an additional liability. And the places that have the most of them are going to be in the most trouble. And that, of course, means Manhattan and Chicago. And to some extent, maybe San Francisco, maybe one or two other places. Because we're going to, the skyscraper, the 60-story condo building, you know, these things are purely the products of a cheap fossil fuel economy. We have no idea whether we're going to be able to run them without liberal supplies of natural gas for heating them, without reliable electricity to run the elevators up to the 34th floor, you know, without really a lot of energy. Somebody wrote, a very misguided article in the New Yorker magazine about a year and a half ago saying, oh, New York City is the most ecological place in the United States. Why? Because you can cram so many people into a one building footprint. You know, and cram them in and stack them up. But what they're overlooking in that, you know, very limited environmental view is that the whole equation changes when you pull the fossil fuels out from under the equation. It's just no longer true. Yeah, okay, it's real ecological, quote, in a society that still has cheap fossil fuel, but otherwise, no, forget it. So we're going to have, you know, our, I think what you're going to see in practical terms is a reversal of the 200-year trend of people moving from the country and the agricultural places and the little towns to the big city. And that's going to reverse, and you'll see people leaving the big cities and moving to the places where agriculture still is viable. Because we're going to have a lot of trouble feeding ourselves. And a lot of trouble even employing ourselves. And by the way, let me just go back to one thing, because I left something out. This whole business about restoring the railroad system in America, an excellent way to put a lot of people to work at jobs that are self-evidently useful and practical and purposeful. So, another consequence of inhabiting the landscape of North America differently is that we're going to have to reestablish a sharper distinction between what is the country and what is the city, between what is the rural and what is the urban. And I think that you know, one of the features of the whole suburban fiasco was the really pervasive idea that everybody could lead an urban life in the rural setting. That was one of the great attractions of the suburban adventure, was that you could exist in all the trappings of the country, and never have to go to the city, but have a professional life that was basically city oriented. And oriented to city activities like, you know, business, book publishing, you know, and all those other kinds of things. And that's going to be, I think, in the decades ahead, you'll see that people who choose to live in the country had better choose country ways of living and country vocations and occupations, because they're not going to be able to lead urban lives there. And often in the comments and questions, invariably, really, somebody will get up and say, can't we all just telecommute? Well, probably not. Not if you're living in a culture that doesn't have 100% reliable electricity. You know, that's another thing that we assume, because we've never lived in a society in the United States where electric service was anything but absolutely reliable except under the most extreme circumstances. You know? But we're probably going to live in a society where the electric service is interrupted from time to time. And it may be a lot. Maybe a little. Sort of depends on where you live. But that's going to be a big problem for the internet. And it's going to be a big problem for telecommuting. And you know, it's the same story with the people who think, oh, well, if we can't do Walmart, we'll just do internet shopping. You know, those people are also forgetting that the UPS truck that delivers your garden furniture has to use exactly as much diesel fuel as the Walmart truck.